Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston. Today, we have Dr. Hector Montenegro, who is president and CEO of the Montenegro Consulting Group. I am delighted to have Dr. Montenegro today because he too is an educator. He has been a math teacher, which math has always been my favorite subject. He's been a principal, a chief of staff for the DC Public Schools, and deputy superintendent and superintendent of schools for 3 school districts of Texas. He has a doctorate from the University of Texas, so we share alma maters, which is delightful to hear. But let me tell you more about Dr. Negro's work. He specializes in multicultural education, social emotional learning, restorative practices, curriculum designs, interactive and engaging pedagogy, technology integration, effective instructional strategies for ELLs, which is English language learners, leadership coaching and development, and parent engagement. So he's well versed as an educator. And he has served on various national boards, and he has received numerous awards as an educator. So I am absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Montenegro here. He lives in Austin, Texas, and he's from LA. And you know, LA Lakers just won the championship, so I'm sure he's been following that. So it's great to have Dr. Montenegro here today. Hello, Dr. Montenegro.
Well, hello, Ramona. This is an absolute pleasure to be participating in this blog. I really am excited about the work that you are doing and have heard other interviews. And so I'm most impressed. And so thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm so happy to have you because you're an educator. And as you know, education is one of the pillars of empowerment. And we are very interested on this podcast in the empowerment of the African-American and Latino communities. So could you tell us a little bit about your professional evolution as an educator and your background, and how did you get into education? And then tell us about your current work.
Absolutely. I'm going to start from the very beginning. That's my parents are from Mexico. My mother's from Guanajuato. Father's family is from Durango, Mexico. And like many immigrants to this country, they came for better opportunities and they ended up in Los Angeles, which I was born. I was one of 5 boys. And growing up in LA, that's quite an adventure. In fact, one of the biggest challenges during my era, that was in the 60s, I was in a school in the 60s and 70s, was, of course, the issues regarding civil rights, regarding the Vietnam War, regarding racial identity. There were just so many things that have actually shaped my perspective of not only my role in society, but my perspective of the world. And it has, I think, really has been a factor in my decisions all along. Went to Stanford University, where I began teaching in San Jose, California. Ended up in Georgetown. I began my doctorate work in Georgetown. So that took me into Washington, D.C., and I worked for the D.C. public schools, worked in the Fairfax County and Arlington school districts, and eventually ended up in Texas, Austin, Texas, where I finished my doctorate at UT Austin. But it was here where I actually was kind of catapulted into the administrative arena in levels of area superintendent in the Dallas public schools or independent school district, and also was superintendent of schools in three districts in Texas here. And so that really has, I think, shaped the kind of work that I'm doing now. And so once I retired, I did not skip a beat. I tell people that I've been involved with education ever since kindergarten. I haven't left it since. But this has really been an exciting time. Some amazing things that have been occurring the last decade in education, as well as most currently with all of the social, the health, and the political dynamics that we're experiencing. And in a way, it almost feels like we've gone full circle. But one of the things that I'm directly involved in is working with school districts. I work with leadership within districts as well. Currently, I'm doing international work. Actually, I've been doing international work for the last 10 years since I retired, but it has taken me to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt, to Japan, to China. Right now, I have a big contract working with the country of Chile, working with the Ministry of Education. And part of my work focuses not only on leadership development, but also on the area of social and emotional development. And that has led me into a number of other areas that I'll share with you in a few minutes. But one of the things that I really enjoy doing is working not only with the adults within a school system, but especially working directly with students. That kind of keep me real. They keep me in tune to what's going on and what their particular needs are. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, but it's been very exciting.
So thank you for telling us a little bit about your background. I know today we're going to focus on the four threads of an equitable, transformational, educational leader. So could you tell us about those four threads and what that means for educators, and how does that empower educators?
Well, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, and there are things that I have begun to be involved more with and to focus in terms of skill development than I did while I was the superintendent of schools, because you get caught up into the turbulence, into the flow, the energy, the pace, the public image, the needs and the demands of the position, and as well as, having two children and a family. You want to balance your life. And I always say, I wish I knew then what I know now. I probably would have made a lot of different decisions. But I've been working with CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic and Social and Emotional Learning, for the past 10 years. And they're located out of Chicago. But they're really one of the leading groups that are focusing on the implementation of social and emotional learning and competencies systemically. And so I've worked with school districts. I've worked with communities and again, also working internationally. And what that has done is helped shape my experience and also my perspective of the work. So currently, I'm also a chairman of the board and a faculty member of the Transformative Educational Leadership Organization. And we had, it's a newly established nonprofit in which we bring in 60 to 70 cohort members. And they participated in a year-long program in which we work with them in terms of developing their skills and competencies to be more effective leaders. And there are four threads to this particular organization and approach that really overlap some of the things that have been siloed in education. And the first and foremost is social and emotional learning. That's deliberate practice of SEL competencies, and CASEL has a wheel in which they identify the four competencies, and that's self-awareness and self-management, social awareness, and also relationship skills, which combine together to help us make responsible decisions that are in the best interest of all those that we serve. And that SEL competency is an ongoing process. It's not about knowing about so emotional intelligence and trying to implement it in a programmatic way, but it's part of the personal evolution, the personal dynamic that helps shape the way we think in terms shapes the way that we make decisions and how we do things. The second thread is mindfulness, that capacity to be present in everyday life, the awareness of not only your own gifts and skills and competencies, but the application and particular time, moments in time, especially now. We need this more now than ever because of the stress of the COVID-19, of students coming back to school. Teachers are saying, even though they're veteran teachers, transitioning over to virtual learning or hybrid or even social distancing, it's like becoming a first-year teacher all over again. It's a whole different set of skills. The third thread within TEL, the Transformative Educational Leadership Program, is equity. And that's really becoming more aware and understanding of the historical and current structural inequities that exist within our society. And what has happened now with this social distancing and isolation, we are seeing the consequence of systems that have been built around inequity and the issue regarding connectivity, participation, inclusion have really been magnified. And we have a lot to go in terms of addressing the issues we're confronted with. And finally, taking the SEL thread, the mindfulness, that ability to manage your emotions and to be present and to also understanding what drives your personal decisions and equity within a system, combining that to form a leadership strategy and capacity to respond to crisis, to respond to the demands and needs of our community, to be more inclusive, and also to take a more global perspective and what is it we're trying to accomplish within our educational system and what we're trying to do to serve our community. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. But again, these are the different components that I have worked with. My own personal journey and search for the meaning in my life has really contributed to the development and the integration of these four threads, which I think are essential for all leaders.
So thank you for sharing those four threads. It seems like you're, of course, you're working for within yourself to be a greater leader through incorporating these threads into your leadership strategy, your own personal leadership strategy. So if looking at, you know, you talked about bringing cohorts in, what do you think is the biggest transformational impact that you have on leaders that participate in this program?
Well, you know, like I was saying, I work for a number of different programs with parent engagement, with English language learners. One of the things that I really value and appreciate with the focus of the TEL program is the emphasis on a diverse participant demographics. So we actively recruit people from different backgrounds, from personal experiences, racial, ethnic backgrounds. So out of the 60 participants we have this year, over 50% are people of color. There's gender diversity, there's identity diversity. And what we're trying to do is to establish a network of people that come from such a diverse background and to guide the conversation around these four threads in order for us to grow personally and to transfer that personal evolution into a more effective, inclusive, equitable, and participatory work and learning environment. And so we're finding that the intention that we have is to ensure that diversity provides the participants a greater scope of experience rather than just bringing a whole lineup of keynote speakers, because that's what we do. We have two webinars a month. We recently had Peter Senge to talk about systemic thinking, and also we'll have Tim Shriver, who is the board of the CASEL organization. He's a board chair of the CASEL. We've had some very significant speakers throughout last year and this year that really have contributed to the personal growth and development. Valerie Brown, that has written a number of books and have led groups to focus on mindfulness. We have Margaret Wheatley and just a number of really significant speakers that really have contributed to the growth of all of our participants.
So how have your participants responded? What do they say they really, that they get out of the program after their participation? I'm glad you mentioned that you bring in a diverse cohort, because I do believe that in learning, much of the learning that you have is not necessarily just from your instructor, but it's also from the people who you are in class with, that you get to have these conversations from diverse perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, can you talk a little bit about how you see how the cohorts have expressed how they have been impacted by the program in terms of their leadership development skills?
Well, that's, I think that's really the great part about the diversity of speakers. One of our first speakers was Yvette Jackson. Yvette Jackson talks about gifting ourselves to gift others, that mindful essence of equity consciousness, mm-hmm. and the pedagogy of confidence is one of her publications. And to Daniel Goleman, that has really been identified as one of the founders of emotional intelligence and also the founders of CASEL and social and emotional learning. And basically what this has done has really stretched their thinking and hearing the many different perspectives regarding mindfulness, regarding emotional intelligence, regarding equity, that really has allowed the participants in our cohort meeting. So we've taken the 60 and divided into five different cohorts and are led by five veteran educators and experienced individuals who have a track record in terms of equity and mindfulness and leadership development, that we spend time with them stretching their thinking. And because of the way that the cohorts are designed, we allow them to explore their own emotions. We allow them to compare notes with one another. And it really has reshaped the way that they see the world, the way that they understand. And when we get our feedback after each session, it's very exciting to hear how these messages resonated with so many people. But it's also even more empowering to hear how people have gone into areas of fear and insecurity to deal with those issues head on, mm-hmm. and understanding how those implicit biases are historical perspective about how we were raised and how we have evolved over time has helping them understand how that shapes their decision making and their biases and their preferences and the way that they treat and respond to people. And so we see people stretching their emotions, stretching their intellectual capability, and stretching their ability to relate and interact with people from different backgrounds. Because, you know, there's some folks there that come from privilege. They're, you know, like I said, there's Asians, there's African Americans, there's Latinos, there's white, there are indigenous populations. So we're dealing with all of these issues regarding intersectionality, and we're getting some very powerful conversations. And so it differs from a university classroom. It differs from any other cohort that I've been involved with, which, you know, you hear speakers and then you intellectually process. But here I see, to the true spirit of the word transformative, transformations occurring every month, every time we meet. It's very impressive.
That is really great to hear about how, you know, people can address all the issues or learn from others in terms of how they feel and how they grew up with certain ideas, certain biases about different people, that they can come and actually explore that on an intellectual level and on an emotional and personal level in order to really directly address many of the challenges that they have in terms of how they make decisions as educational leaders.
Absolutely. It's changed this year, but last year we had our July retreat at the Omega Institute in New York. And there it was the very first meeting. It was a 5-day retreat. We also had a virtual retreat this year with this cohort. This is the second cohort. But they had the opportunity to meet with one another. Virtually, we put them into breakout rooms. We give them prompts, but they have the opportunity to explore their ideas and to compare notes with others and to hear other people share their perspectives about either a topic or a presentation and to interact. We have within that framework, we have role-alikes. So people that come may be principals or maybe teachers or central office staff. Or we have a few superintendents or consultants. We even have yoga teachers and people that are community leaders. And they can explore how the content applies to their particular circle of influence and their realm of engagement. But we also have the racial affinity groups. And we actually have groups that are Asian, Southeast Asian, as well as Latino and African American, and even the white affinity group. And once we talk about race, well, once we talk about identity and culturally relevant or culturally responsive education, then we take it back to our affinity groups and we talk about how that applies to us. And they're just powerful conversations. Some of them just don't want to end their conversation. From our first cohort, many of the affinity groups are still working together and still discussing and exploring their own privilege and their own experiences and their own personal dynamics and how it applies to their decision making and their work. So, oh yeah, it really is hands on and it really has made a profound difference in how people respond to the demands even of now.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the organization with us. Can you tell us the name of the organization again and how, if people are interested in participating in the program, they could possibly get in touch with you and the program?
Yes, and there's a couple of things that, you know, I wanted to also share with you regarding some of the other, I think, contributing factors to my growth and development. But first and foremost is the CASEL, Collaborative for Academic and Social Emotional Learning. CASEL, CASEL, .org. And that really does, I think, really allow us to explore the SEL, I think, perspective a little bit better. We have the TEL.org. That's the Transformative Educational Leadership. And you can go to that website and get additional information regarding the work of TEL and what it's done to, I think, help people transform the work that they're doing. But also, I do a lot of work, again, internationally. I work with the State Department. And one of the other organizations, as I serve on different boards, is the New York City Leadership Academy. And they're focusing on developing principals and school leaders and focusing on equity as well. That's really opened up a whole new arena for me in terms of the demands of the position now, which differs from when I was a principal. And lastly, I just want to talk to you about the Fruit Tree Planting Foundation.
It's
a foundation that I work for, volunteer, and I've been to Brazil with them, Uganda, El Salvador, and different countries, and even done some planting domestically. And what that has helped me do, in addition to the more formal work I do, this work allows me to go into different communities throughout the world and to see some of the the basic needs that we as human beings have, and also the common family ties, the emotions, the desire to belong and to participate and to be validated. And it really has given me a global perspective and how we need to work within our community, our local community, rather than fighting for our own little crumbs and the things that we want and need as a racial and ethnic groups. We need to close ranks together and value each other's language, and value each other's culture, and value each other's historical background in a way that it is very inclusive. I see us kind of diverging off into different arenas, and it's not healthy for our country, and it's not healthy for us as a community to just only focus on our own world of experience and ethnicity and also our own perspective. So I'm going to say this, that within the Latino community, we have our issues. We have our prejudice. You know, when I went to Mexico for the very first time and spent time traveling, I saw the oppression against indigenous populations. I saw the exclusion. I saw the hoarding of resources. And then as I've traveled the world, I see it in all communities. But I also see people who fight and are pursuing a more global and inclusive perspective. And I'll tell you that when I see Black and brown and white and Asian and indigenous populations, children being brought together, this is what my experience would tell has been: when you bring adults together, they feel more secure in understanding and bringing diverse children together intentionally, by design. And I think that's what we need to do is have a more global perspective of our outreach, certainly valuing the culture, valuing the language, valuing our racial roots and histories, which really is who we are, genetically, emotionally, psychologically, physically, but at the same time, knowing that we can create a better world by taking a more global perspective of how we all are interconnected and interdependent.
Dr. Montenegro, I'm so glad that you expanded upon that about how the tree project that has taken you across the world has really helped you to recognize and value culture and difference even more in terms of looking at it from a global perspective. One of the things that is so true to me and my heart is that we all, like you said, we all need to value each other's cultures and value difference, but at the same time, create community. We can create community by working together. We can create a global community by respecting each other's nations and cultures and differences. And so I'm so glad that you pointed that out in terms of your work and how you see that is important too.
Absolutely. You know, growing up in LA, it was predominantly Latino community that we lived in, but you know, there's such a diverse population there. But you know, I was in the DC public schools. I was one of the highest ranking Latinos in the school district as chief of staff. And I really experienced some things that I didn't when I was growing up, and that is really working a lot closer with the African-American community and looking at all of us, educating each other and sharing our work together, because it's not about, again, fighting against each other. But it is about a program when I was in Dallas, there was a fundraiser for a they had just started one of the female schools, school for just girls, and they had a fundraiser at one of the, I think it was an IHOP. They were serving breakfast, And two African-American girls came up to me and said, bienvenidos, you know, and it was just to me, that's really what it means. You know, they welcomed me and they asked me how I was doing in Spanish. And they said that they were really wanting to learn Spanish because a lot of their peers spoke Spanish. And rather than resenting and dividing, it was combining and learning from one another, you know. And what a lot of people don't often acknowledge, even within the Latino community, we have such a diverse racial makeup. We have Dominicanos that are from African roots and speak Spanish. We have Panamanian that are Spanish speaking, but they're also descendants from Africa, and just diverse populations throughout all the Latino community. And one of our common threads, of course, relates to the Spanish history of Spain. So we have a lot of cultural similarities. And yet when we come and look at the sort of the rainbow, the difference of cultures and racial makeup of our Latino community, I can't help to say, my Black brothers and sisters, you know, we are closely tied. We are connected. We have a lot more in common than we do different. And I think it's true for the white community, Asian, African-American, and the indigenous populations. We do need to close ranks and learn more about each other.
Totally agree with you. Thank you so much for expanding on that. And if you... you know, I want to leave with a call to action to our audience. And I'm a big advocate for social responsibility and each of us embracing our role and responsibility to contribute to society. So if you could leave our audience with a call to action, what would that be?
Well, right now, under our current circumstances, they're just an outcry for us to be very proactive. I think going back to understanding our own particular state of mind, our own particular needs, the first thing is take care of yourself. You can't serve others if you can't really take care of yourself. And it's like I heard the saying is, you can't pour from an empty cup. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be stronger emotionally, physically, psychologically, and spiritually. And that is a part of the decision-making process that we have in order to better serve our community in a more inclusive and proactive way. So I think the call to action is that we absolutely need to close ranks. We need to get out there and vote, and we need to vote responsibly. Mm-hmm. It would shape our better society for all of us. So right now is get out the vote, get out from all communities, and knowing that we are in this together, and the only way we can solve these problems is that we close ranks and we work collectively and collaboratively.
Great advice. Take care of yourself and make sure you take care of the community and nation by going out and voting. Thank you so much, Dr. Montenegro. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you today. And I want to have you back because you are so engaging. And I love your ideas and your background and everything you have to offer. And I'm sure my audience would love to have you back as well.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And again, I wish you continued success. You're doing great work. Continue to get that word out there and bring in folks that can help communicate that message.
Thank you. Hi, I have Dr. Hector Montenegro here as my guest today, and he's going to give us one piece of advice for students who are in college who want to be successful. Hi, Dr. Montenegro.
How are you? Good to see you, and it's just a pleasure to be here with you, Ramona.
Thank you. Thank you. And so tell our audience what colleges you attended, your majors and your degrees, and what that strategy you would give students for college success.
Well, my college experience is very diverse. I grew up in Los Angeles and in LA, and my goal in life was to be an auto mechanic. And while I was in high school, I took auto mechanics. I love working on cars, and I was working in a auto shop part-time after school and during the weekends. And so that was my destiny. But somebody convinced me I needed to go to college, and I didn't want to go. No one else in my family had gone to college with five brothers. They hadn't gone to school yet. And so finally, I was admitted into the Educational Opportunities Program, EOP program, at Cal Poly in Pomona, right outside of Los Angeles. And I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. Now, this was in the late 60s and early 70s. And I was the only Latino in the engineering program, mechanical engineering, because I wanted to go into automotive design because I loved cars. And at that time, we actually used slide rules. They had not invented the handheld calculator at the time. So I was the only Latino, and there was one female, and the rest of the students in the program were all white males. Well, I really had a hard time adjusting to that cultural transition there. And but my involvement was with the MECHA, which it's the Latino organization, university organization, and the only one at the time, El Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán, which really promoted the education of Latino students. So I got involved with that and changed my major to education, because I started tutoring children in the city of Pomona, and that just changed my life. That one decision, that was like that fork in the road, that whether to stay in engineering or to get into education, and I decided to go into math education because I had a math background. Well, I ended up graduating and a degree in math, and then I was accepted to Stanford University in the Teacher Core program. So I couldn't afford college when I went to my undergrad, so I was in the Educational Opportunities Program. The Teacher Corps program paid for my education at Stanford University, and so that's where I got my teaching degree and began teaching math in San Jose, California. But also at Stanford, I got involved with student organizations that helped me through that university. Later on, I got accepted into Georgetown University to begin my doctorate studies on a Title VII grant, which was part of the bilingual education program there. But once I got involved with the school district, I became a principal in two schools in the DC area and became a chief of staff. Then I moved to Austin, where I finished my doctorate degree at UT Austin and became superintendent of schools of three districts. So here's my word of advice. Now, it's not a straight line. I realized that I did not get a good education in high school. I could hardly write. I was fairly good in math. But what saved my life is turning to others for help, being involved with support groups, getting tutors, getting resources to help. You can't do it alone. And you really have to hang out with the right people that are really interested and committed into completing their education and to that are in your field as well. I changed my major. There was nothing wrong with that. Sometimes people think, oh, God, you can't even decide. That's okay. Look at I'm approaching 70, and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up, you know. But in college, it's a matter of exploring, of learning, explore your different areas of interest, but also expand your borders. There are people from many different backgrounds and many different experiences. And so that social context, balancing out that academic, was, to me, life-changing and really helped me through the rest of my academic career. Otherwise, I saw points all along the way. I almost didn't finish, almost dropped out of undergrad, almost didn't finish Stanford, but others pushed me along, and I almost didn't finish my doctorate degree. My advisor just kept prodding me and said, do it, you can do it, you know? And here I am. Dr. Hector, who would have known?
Well, thank you so much for that great advice. You know, it's so important that we surround ourselves with affirming people who will push us on to that finish line.
Absolutely.
And you explained it so eloquently, and the importance of just making sure, where would you be had it not been for Mechai, you know, and the people who pushed you along the way.
Absolutely.
So, and also that it's not a straight line. A lot of young people who are pursuing the college, sometimes they think it's easy, and if they don't go the straight line, then somehow they your failure, and your experience has shown us that it's not. You know, you just keep pushing and keep moving along.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hector. We appreciate that advice.
Thank you, Ramona. A real pleasure.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.